It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 281 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. In fact, this week I've got a real treat for you when I talk with Ben Kahn, the creator of Heavenly Blues and Shaman. Heavenly Blues is coming out from Scout Comics, as we discuss. Ben is one of those people who is a delight to talk with. He makes me laugh and laugh during this interview, and I think he will make you laugh too, as well as give you information about the books that he creates. And the kinds of things that he brings to the industry really is something special, and I'm really glad I got to talk with him and met him at C2E2 this year. We discuss Heavenly Blues and the characters therein, as well as what the future holds for the series. So I'm sure you're going to enjoy what he has to say. There's a lot to get to, so let's get on with the show. I'm happy to welcome to the podcast Ben Kahn, creator of a graphic novel called Shaman, but more recently a series that's coming out from Scout Comics called Heavenly Blues. How are you doing today, Ben?
Doing great. Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's good to talk with you. I want to start with something on your website, just because I got a big kick out of it.
All right.
People's websites are often some of the more entertaining places to get information about somebody. And I'm going to read off. It's BenKahnComics.com. And we should make sure everybody knows it's K-A-H-N, Kahn.
Yes. Not like the Star Trek villain.
That's right. You don't go around with a fake chest and things like
no.
that.
No.
No, okay.
I heard that's real. I heard Ricardo Montalban is just super ripped. And I don't know if it's true, but I want to believe. I like thinking that Ricardo Montalban is just really, like, was just in really great shape for a really long time.
Well, they say that Captain Kirk has hair, but William Shatner does not.
Ricardo Montalban, like, gives me faith in humanity. Shatner's Shatner. He ain't doing anything bad for the world, but he ain't doing much good for it.
No, well, you know, hey.
He's just Shatner.
Mister, he is. Anyway, your website says, Ben Kahn is a writer working in New York City. Ben has been writing for over a decade with experience in webcomics and video games before releasing his debut graphic novel in 2015, which is the previously mentioned Shaman. Mm-hmm. Ben divides his time between working on the latest comic book projects and earning his MBA at NYU, which is real interesting. So I got to kick out. Now, how in the world do you get time to do this stuff? Because an MBA, and of course that has to do, if you're in comics, why would you want an MBA? So I'm just going to overload you with questions. Why don't you, whatever you feel like talking about, why don't you go ahead and talk about it?
Okay, yes. I'm actually about a week and a half away from graduating business school.
Congratulations.
With my MBA, so been working through finals.
Good for you.
Actually finished a bunch of presentations and projects and essays, so... Yesterday, I actually finally had time. I got to sit down and start work on the Heavenly Blues number 5 script, which is nice. Mm-hmm. How do I find time for it? Mm-hmm. Avoid finance. I try to do my best to get through it with doing as little math as possible.
Okay.
What math I did have to do was unfortunate and tragic, but sacrifices have to be made. And you know, why, if I want to be in comics, do I want to know business? Mm-hmm. Because I know the history of comics, and I know just how many people were completely screwed over because they didn't have a good business sense. Mm-hmm. I'm going to plug the Batman and Bill documentary on Hulu, which is just phenomenal, mm-hmm. about the history and the story of Bill Finger. Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, it's NYU especially, to kind of give my now alma mater a plug. As far as business schools go, has a very good entertainment program. So that was very useful, getting to just learn a lot more about the nuts and bolts and like the how all our like television and movies and publishing gets made. Mm-hmm. I just figure going ahead in comics as a content provider, knowing the other side of that can only be useful.
Mm-hmm.
And if it gets me a bigger paycheck to pay artists, that's one hell of a bonus.
Good. Good. Sounds great. Now, an important thing to know is you're creating comics. How long have you been into comics?
So I started really reading like your kind of Marvel, DC, Image books. I didn't really start reading any of those books until I was a freshman in college.
Ooh.
I read webcomics, and I'd done some webcomic stuff before then in high school, but it really wasn't until I was like 18 that I kind of first really discovered real comic books, and then it just became this absolute passion, this obsession. How like sophomore year, I even managed to get a job at a comic book store near campus, which was just putting a kid in a candy store. I had it was like a research library, and I just tried learning everything I can, and really just, I know it's weird that like the comics just weren't a part of my childhood. The animated cartoons were like the X-Men and Spider-Man movies. I had those growing up, but again, I really didn't read a comic until I was 18, and it just was this absolute spark.
How did you do it? Did somebody introduce you to them?
I got introduced to some stuff. I'd been shown, like, notably Runaways. Runaways was kind of a big gateway. I'd say that was, like, the first real comic that I'd ever went out and really looked for and bought. So that was definitely a big entryway. But really what it was access. In my hometown, there just wasn't a comic book store. I turned out to, and then when I got to college, there was one just a block off campus. So just for the first time, I could stumble across a place to buy comics. I knew that comics were still going on, but I hadn't the faintest idea where you actually went to get them. And then, you know, suddenly suburb kid in the big city finds out about those comics and then goes on a dark downward spiral. Tale as old as time.
That's so interesting because, you know, you're right. Usually people, when they're children, access comics. But you, as a young adult, basically getting into it, that's kind of a different avenue. So that's pretty smooth. It's actually good for the industry that people who are a little older get into it because your expectations are probably way different than a kid might be.
There is no, like, point at DC or Marvel that I could point to and go, like, it should be how it was when I was a kid, because I had no idea how things were a kid. So I kind of approached, like, superhero comics especially, I kind of approached as almost a study in history. And I love superheroes. I love the shared universe. But what I really love about him is that constant sense of change, not necessarily like in the plot details, but in what stories are told, how they're told, what characters they're told with, what kind of creators they are. And just that tapestry of change, the fact that for everything from Frank Miller to Adam West to Christian Bale to Ben Affleck to Kevin Conroy, all these different versions of Batman, all of them equally valid, is something that really, really drove me into superhero comics specifically. And then your Vertigo and your Image books, those are just phenomenal stories. So why wouldn't you get into them?
They must have shaped you as far as your college experience, though, because you're talking about getting an MBA and stuff like that, because being a person that wants to make comics, you want to be smart about how you do it. Was that an influence in your college experience? I mean, what you chose as a major and things like that?
Oh, absolutely. I went into college. I mean, the schools I applied for because I thought it was going to be a chemistry major, go be a scientist. That lasted about 2.5 hours. And then I was probably already leaning more towards English, and then the comics just confirmed it. I mean, I picked exclusively classes that I thought would teach me the most about writing, about story structure, that, hell, would just give me an opportunity to take the stories that I had in my head and, hell, get to work on them and write them on school time. You know, I'd be taking those short story classes everyone else is writing about. The old man, full of regrets, goes down in the old pickup truck and looks out at the lake his father took him fishing on. And then I come in with my story. It's like, okay, so the mummy just had sex with the vampire, and now they're fighting in midair.
They must say, we couldn't wait till you got up and read your story.
I took fiction writing and advanced fiction writing for the same teacher. She gave me a not-so-good grade the first semester, but then I came back for the second one, and I got, like, an A or an A-minus.
Oh, wow.
And eventually the comments I just got was, like, I wore her down, and the comment I got was, I have no idea what you're doing, but at this point I think you're doing a good job at it.
Oh, good. Chris, all this is going to impact on what you're doing now. This is the best part about this. We'll get to that in a second, but I'm just kind of curious, is that when you got out of college and you went in to do the master's degree, I mean, what kind of work could you find as far as doing those kinds of things? Now, you were doing webcomics, your website says, and video games and stuff like that. How do you get into that? I mean, how do you know people? Is that how you get into doing that?
So my first job out of college was actually working for a mobile game developer, which is a company I worked at for 3 years. And it was actually comics that helped me get that job, because the specific position they were looking for was someone that could kind of manage art assets and work with artists and work as a go-between between designers and artists. Mm-hmm. And Shaman wasn't out yet, but like I'd started production on it. Mm-hmm. So just that particular background, that unique background of working with artists, despite not being an artist, was this, like, it was an irregular shaped peg in an irregular shaped hole, but it got my foot in the door and it mm-hmm. got me East Coast to the bone. It got me all the way out to California in Silicon Valley, mm-hmm. where I eventually worked up, became a designer. Mm-hmm. I could spend an hour just telling you about the mobile game industry. instead, I'll just say, if you ever see the South Park episode mm-hmm. where Stan gets addicted to the Terrence and Phillip mobile game and mm-hmm. the Canadian Devil, it's accurate about everything. All I'll just say is that the mobile game industry is completely toxic and runs on a business model that is completely counter to any sense of good game design.
Oh, wow.
Intentionally.
Oh, wow.
But you know what? It paid for me to give my artist on Shaman a page rate, mm-hmm. and I'm proud of Shaman, so all's well that ends well.
That's cool.
I made really bad art so I could afford to make good art.
Now, I got to ask you something. Are there examples of the video games you were involved with still around?
Oh, I hope not. So the main game I worked on for a real long time was a game called Shipwrecked.
Okay.
Which was, you know those village builders where you're just building a town, mm-hmm. and then eventually it takes you like 12 hours to build anything unless you want to give like $20 and a kidney. And it's just a money sink. Like, you're never actually accomplishing anything. You're just building more crap mm-hmm. to do nothing except exist. Mm-hmm. That was what I worked on.
Oh, wow.
And this is like a 2-year-old game, like a 2.5-year-old game mm-hmm. when I became like the lead designer on it. But I've been working on like lower positions all that time. Mm-hmm. I'm the head creative in the game. 70% of my job was Googling two random words together, seeing if it would Google spat out a good reference image that I could then send to the artist. And so the theme was, it's the 17th century colonial era, like British people, mm-hmm. and they're stuck on, and like they're on this abandoned tropical island. Mm-hmm. So there's your theme, try to work within that. Except by the time I came on, like I had a say in what went into the game. This game had already gone through like 3 lead designers who had been throwing in like dinosaurs and rocket ships and sci-fi crap mm-hmm. and like mystical horror, like Friday the 13th stuff. Mm-hmm. And it got to the point where by the time it got to me, it was not only like, A, why should I care about the theme? Nobody else did. And B, what the hell is left?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I don't know. I might have to look and see if that game's around anywhere. It would be kind of fun to see.
Yeah, Shipwrecked. It's... I mean, look, there's no credits. Mm-hmm. And there's no credits. There's nowhere where you can look up the code and you'll find my name in it. Mm-hmm. But I'm perfectly fine with that.
Okay. Well, good news about that was, is that got you into Shaman, which started you as a comics person. Do you want to?
Yes.
Why don't we touch on that a little before we get into Heavenly Blues quite heavily? That Shaman.
Oh, that sounds good. Yeah.
You gave a little bit of a description of it. Talk a little bit more about what Shaman's about.
So Shaman is about a magician and his teenage sorceress daughter going on crazy supernatural misadventures. Think Hellblazer meets Rick and Morty. The more insular summary is that it's about a necromancer who can bring dead superheroes and supervillains back to life and does so in a series of one-shot adventures and two-parters with his daughter and a superhero who decides to quit and join up with them. And this kind of little makeshift family deals with the craziest crap I could throw at him.
Mm-hmm. There's one line that I really liked in particular that Necromancer says. He says, I'm only happy when it rains, which I got a kick out of.
Oh, yeah, no, I love 90s alt rock and grunge, so I just peppered in tons of little 90s music references into every issue.
Mm-hmm. It came out in 2015, right? So how long were you working on that before it came out?
So I was working on that for around 4 years. I started writing it in the summer of 2011. Bruno Hidalgo, the artist, probably joined on the project maybe six, eight months after that. Mm-hmm. Like, it took me a while to finish that first script and then sat on not really knowing quite what to do with it until I teamed up with Locust Moon and they helped really put the project in motion. And then since we decided to kind of do the entire miniseries first before releasing it, we took a while for production. It took us around, again, that like 3.5 years to make the 5 issues. Mm-hmm. And we did a Kickstarter to fund the production, which was great. Distributed through Diamond, it's a really awesome feeling walking into Forbidden Planet and seeing a book with your name on it in between Spider-Man and Saga.
Wow. Wow, how about that?
So that was a nice feeling.
Pretty smooth. And of course, that leads into Heavenly Blues. And now that I've talked a little bit with you, I get a little bit of better sense as to why you write the things that you do. Because, you know, most comic people are what we call Long John's fans. They like costumes and those kinds of characters. But your stories tend, the costume characters aren't necessarily the heroic people in the bunch.
I grew up with my dad watching like Scorsese movies and stuff like that. So I love like the trickster and like that kind of like thief with the heart of gold, like in Sting. Mm-hmm. I like con men, liars, and thieves. I don't quite know what it says about me, but those seem to be the people I like writing the most. I like making bad people look good.
Well, you know, honestly, there's a trend of that. You're hitting the comic industry right at the right time because there are starting to be more and more books that look at, say, quote-unquote criminals and kind of examine who they are. And maybe because they're good at what they do, maybe that doesn't make them necessarily bad people.
Yeah, I love the intersection between fantastic and mundane. Mm-hmm. To go back a little bit to Shaman, the fifth and final issue is, the story of that is Shaman has a 4th of July barbecue and the whole neighborhood comes over. So I love when fantastic people do it. I love watching Dragon Ball, and it's an episode where Vegeta, the evil conquering Saiyan prince, has to take his family to Club Med. That's my favorite. It's my favorite goddamn episode of Dragon Ball.
Okay, well, this segues perfectly into Heavenly Blues because, once again, you've got very different characters. You know, one of the biggest tropes in comics are big, strapping white guys who are the heroes, and they're the main characters. And you have to say about Heavenly Blues.
One of those to be found.
I was going to say, there is none of that in there that I've seen so far. And I've read the first two issues. Do you want to give a little bit of it, like, the same thing like you did with Shaman, a little bit of a TV guide explanation of what the series is about?
Yeah, so Heavenly Blues is about the souls of the greatest thieves in hell teaming up to pull the ultimate heist on heaven. It centers around Isaiah Jefferson, a charismatic bank robber from the Great Depression, and Erin Foley, a super pissed 12-year-old girl who has had 400 years to reflect on being a trickster on a con artist who tried to escape the Salem witch trials. A fucking shit heel of an angel comes down offering them a deal too good to be true. And it kind of kicks them out of their malaise and sets off on what should be a, to use the tagline that I give myself so much credit for coming up with, a jazz and brimstone infused heist through heaven and hell.
Cool. Okay, now where's the title come from, Heavenly Blues? Why do you call it that?
Because titles are really hard to come up with. So even though one of the big things that appealed to me about doing Heavenly Blues was just that this team comes from all over time in the world, you know, feudal Japan, ancient Egypt, while Salem witch trials, the main character is very much the Isaiah Jefferson, the gangster, the bank robber character from the Great Depression from the 20s and 30s. And just him being the main character, that kind of visual style, that kind of visual language, that iconography kind of just permeates throughout the book as a general kind of default. Mm-hmm. So really just a name that with the heavenly, we get, you know, the sense of the celestial heaven, hell setting of the story. But with blue, but I call it heavenly blues. It's really something about trying to sell more, establish the kind of mood and atmosphere of mm-hmm. the book.
Mm-hmm. Now, we should point out that Isaiah is a man of color in this
book.
Yeah. We need to understand that right away. Although...
he is a black guy.
Yeah, and Aaron is a white girl.
Yes.
Which is interesting. So this is kind of different from what we're used to. It usually be the other way around. You know, Batman right now is a white guy who has a black... They don't want to use the word sidekick. They got something else going on.
I don't know what Duke Thomas, who is... Yeah. He doesn't have a code name, and that really bothers me. Right now, he's just yellow hockey pad boy.
They better be careful, because if we come up with a name, it's not going to be nearly as poetic as, but they might come up with
it. No, I think I saw a lark on a wiki or whatever. Yeah. Maybe they just go with that. Just give him something.
Mm-hmm. Now, at the beginning of the book, of course, we see Isaiah right off the bat, and he's got a special role at the beginning of the series, which I get a kick out of. He's kind of torturing people who just come to hell. And what's the greatest thing about him, he looks all very prim and proper. He's got a tie and a vest, and he's standing there, and he's doing all this stuff. And, of course, he and Aaron get into a big argument over what kind of things he should be doing to people. And I got a huge kick out of that because, you know, you always kind of figure, everybody always figures when you get to hell, it must be everybody else gets along because, you know, they're all basically the same kind of person. But the way you present it, these people may not get along at all because they're...
Oh, no. God, no.
Because they don't get along. They sit and argue all the time, which is the funniest thing about I get such a kick out of that, you know, that you think people with similar things might actually integrate properly, but these guys in no way do that. So that was one of the most entertaining things.
No, and I'll tell you why. Because I'm Jewish, and I know that when deprived of all stimuli, there is no greater entertainment than a good argument.
Well, the first book really got me. I really enjoyed it. This is where the setup starts to happen. We get to see the angel come and kind of talk with them. And, of course, based on what we've already been talking, you can say that Isaiah and Aaron aren't necessarily in agreement as to how they should proceed, which I got a kick out of.
No, and, you know, that kind of reflects they both have very different attitudes towards their presence in hell. Mm-hmm. Isaiah really isn't, like, that bad a guy, but he's an outlaw. Robbed banks, he stole, he killed some people. He knows exactly why he's in hell. He gets it. He has regrets, but he doesn't question how he got here. He knows that it was like every decision was his to make. Erin feels very cheated. She feels that she's like a 12-year-old girl. She was 12 years old when she died. She felt she was given absolutely nothing in life, was given no real choices to make. Mm-hmm. And then feels like adding insult to injury and is now being told that on top of that she's a bad person who should be punished for this absolute just life that gave her no choice but to do bad things. Mm-hmm. So he's resigned to his guilt while she's just – well, even though she's died when she was 12, she's now had 400 years to just simmer until she's just pure bubbling anger and resentment.
Mm-mm-mm. 12-year-old, just like that, boy. That sounds like some of the 12-year-olds I've actually known, so.
Right? Man, tweens are the meanest people. They're the meanest.
Mm.
I think back to when I was like 12 through 14. Mm-hmm. Holy shit, I was the worst human being. I was awful.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, one of the great things about issue 2, and I don't want to get too much into it, but let's just say we get a little more of the background of Aaron. You explain a little bit about her history, which is really good. And then they start to assemble a team, basically, as to how...
It's a high story. Got to have you putting the band together sequence.
That's right. That's right. It's good. I really want to talk about the fact that you self-published this, but now you're getting picked up by Scout. Talk a little bit about that process, because this was an indie comic, they call it, but Scout has come along and is going to give you a little wider audience. Do you want to talk about that? I mean, as far as like self-publishing and being an indie comics creator and stuff like that, that seems like a natural fit for you, especially being somebody who understands the business aspects of things. How did the story come? I mean, how did you decide to do this?
So in terms of doing it self-published, that was always intended to be like a small, limited thing. Pitching it to publishers like Scout and working with them was always the goal. But I figured that is something that takes time. And in the meantime, as soon as I had, especially that first issue ready, I could go out, print a real small batch myself, go out to shows, go to a few stores, try to just build a little bit of buzz and pre-awareness and get it to where someone like where they might see it rather than me. And so the self-publishing strategy was always something kind of in service towards working with a publisher like Scout. Mm-hmm. And it was, the first time I kind of my path crossed with Scout was when I was at FlameCon and I met one of the people that worked there and also one of their creators, AC Medina, and we first started out talking. So just the fact that I had it there really to show proof of product then made the process very smooth and great to work with. So I'm really excited to work with Scout. Like I said, with Shaman, I did a Kickstarter there. So just the fact that I'll be working with them to produce the book and have it distributed, especially like through Diamond and have it in stores, that's just really awesome. Definitely Shaman was my first time in stores, but that was a graphic novel. So having single issues come out in stores was definitely part of the dream I want, like definitely a big part of the what I want to accomplish of Heavenly Blues. So I'm really, really excited for what comes next.
Oh boy, because now I was just thinking you could get into a store and you might see a trade paperback there, and now you might see issues, ongoing issues in different stores. You know, you might walk into several stores because you live in the New York area. You might get into several stores where you see your different books there.
Yeah.
So that might be something different for a comics creator. I can imagine that's a pretty high experience.
Yeah, I mean, fuck it. I think you got to be a little bit vain and egotistical to get into this game. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's going to feel pretty dang amazing.
See, the title to me, I always thought that it was going to have to do with jazz. Something was going to be jazz singers or something. So I actually liked the fact that I got into it and I found it was something different than what I expected. A lot darker than what I thought it was going to be. I thought they were going to be like a band that was going to go playing in heaven or something like that. I wasn't quite sure what it was. But to me, when I got into it, I discovered the darker premise that you were going to do. I really liked that. And so I thought, okay, I like it when a book surprises me, is better than what I expect. And so that's what I liked about your book. And when I first talked to Brendan Dineen several weeks back on this podcast, this was one of the books he was really high on. He talked about how much he liked Heavenly Blues.
Kill, make me blush.
So that's why I got into it, because I started reading. I've been catching up on several of the Scout comics because I think the Scout company is doing a really good job of providing quality stuff.
I've loved working with Scout. They've been really amazing partners, and I'm really excited for where the book's going to go with them, and I'm really excited for how they're going to continue to grow and evolve as a publisher, because I think they're definitely an outfit on the rise, and I'm really glad to be working with them.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said you're working on issue number 5. How many stories are in Heavenly Blues? Is this kind of a mini-series? Is this going to be ongoing? How are you going to do this?
Yeah, this is going to be a mini-series. Mm-hmm. This is going to be a 6-issue tale. Mm-hmm. We're working on the art for issue 3 is moving along really nicely and is looking like a really cool issue. I'm working on issue 5, which should be a fun one. And then issue 6 will be the last one. And hey, who knows if there's demand for it and if this does well. I think there's kind of a sequel miniseries that could be done. But I think this is going to be a really satisfying 6-issue tale that should have a really complete ending.
Well, good writers are never satisfied with one story. I imagine there are some, granted, that are only one story things. But, you know, when you develop a cast like this and you develop a situation like this, sometimes all you have to do is tinker a little bit and it shoots you off in another direction. And it's just as much fun as the original was.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is, in a lot of ways, Heavenly Blues is my tribute, is like a love letter to all the great crime and heist movies that I grew up with, you know, like Sting, Ocean's 11, Italian Job, hell, just playing Sly Cooper, reading Liza Locke Lamora, Parker. I mean, just all the great thief stories and just trying to put my own weird spin and take on it, but do something true to the genre. Mm-hmm.
Well, I like it. Like I said, it's not like I expect other mini books to be. It's very profound and it's a great it's a great character study, as well as, you know, sometimes when there's discussion, the story lags, but when you guys, your characters talk, it propels the story forward in such a powerful way that I'm entertained by watching and reading what you're doing.
Yeah, and thank you. I'm glad to hear that. I have a trouble shutting up, and by extension, my characters tend to have trouble shutting up. In terms of dialogue and my dialogue style as a writer, I'm actually a pretty kind of dialogue first in my style. Like when I'm first writing a page, I might just freeform, just write out the lines as they come to me. Mm-hmm. And then after that, try to figure out the panel structure and what works. Mm-hmm. But that goes back to when I was doing a web comic way back in the day. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, 15 in high school, I started this. Mm-hmm. And it was just they called it a sprite comic, and would take old, like, pixelated video game poses, and you would manipulate them in Microsoft Paint or Photoshop, and you'd make a comic, like a little 4-panel comic strip out of that. So that's what I did. And because, like, the backgrounds and all the poses, it was all, like, pre-made. There was no real creativity there. Really, the only element of this strip that I was creating from scratch, that I was making new, that I could make it stand out, was the dialogue. So I think as weird and as that webcomic was, and as undeveloped as it was, it really kind of forced me to really spend a lot of time honing in on dialogue. So I'm really glad that's something that really worked for you.
It really was fun. I'm enjoying it. Now, of course, I've seen the two issues. I met you at C2E2 this year.
Yes, amazing show.
Yeah, it was great. It was really great fun. I met a lot of good folks up there, including you up there. And your books were some of the highlights to me of the C2 stuff. I managed to get back to the hotel room the night after I got your stuff, and I got into Heavenly Blues. I read those there. And unfortunately, the convention didn't last long enough, so I got all the way through Shaman. But I got to read the two Heavenly Blues they did. Now, the question, of course, is, how do people get your stuff? How do people get Shaman? How do people get Heavenly Blues? Do you know the release schedule that Scout is doing as far as Heavenly Blues?
Yeah, so Heavenly Blues, the first issue comes out July 26th. Mm-hmm. If you want to order it, please go to your local comic book store, go to them, call, email, tell them you want Heavenly Blues number one. Mm-hmm. The Diamond order code on that is May 17, 1769. So, yeah, it's through Diamond. Just tell your retailer, tell your local shop that you want it. Pre-orders are super important at this stage, so tell your store owner. I could say that 1,000 times.
Now, are these issues going to come out bi-monthly, monthly? How are you going to do this? Because you're ahead of the game.
Yeah, my hope is that by the time issue one comes out, issue three will be completely done, and we'll be starting issue four, which would be a real nice cushion for things. Mm-hmm. It's coming out monthly. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be coming out starting in July monthly. And as for Shaman, you can find that. I have an Etsy store, BenCon Comics on Etsy. And you can also find it on Amazon, just Shaman Volume 1 by BenCon and Bruno Hidalgo. The individual issues for Shaman are on Comixology.
Ah, okay. So I always like Comixology because if you can't find a paper somewhere, you can at least get the digital and you can read those.
Yeah, it's on Comixology. Comixology was another great partner. They gave Shaman a lot of publicity and push, and I'm grateful for them. I've been lucky. I've gotten to work with a lot of really great, talented people so far.
Very good. Now, I have to ask, of course, and I ask everybody who works with Scout this, one of the benefits of being around Scout is that Brendan has connections to people in, say, the television or movie industry. Have you given any thought to what you would do if somebody came to you and said, I'd like to make Shaman or Heavenly Blues into a TV series or a movie?
I mean, I'd be lying if I said I hadn't thought of that. You kidding? Of course I daydream of that. Who doesn't? Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, what you're doing is you're giving people a script. You're saying, this is how you could do it visually, and this is how you could pace it. And this is, it gives a lot of information to somebody about how somebody could make, like Shaman could be a movie, or Heavenly Blues could be an ongoing miniseries or something like that, and say Netflix or something.
Absolutely.
Like, so you're actually telling people, this is how you do it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that'd be awesome. I mean, who wouldn't love to be able to point to a movie or a TV show and be like, hey, that's based off a thing I did. Mm-hmm. I did a thing, and then they made another thing. I mean, of course, that'd be awesome. I mean, look, I know, I think anything going on there would be in, like, the sitting in mailbox stage, if anything. I certainly don't know anything, but hey, from your lips to God's ears, any TV movie executives want to pick up Heavenly Blues, I sure as hell wouldn't mind that.
That's right. Now, I was thinking what you could do is you go into a store, and let's say your comics are there, and they've made a TV show out of Heavenly Blues, and they're showing it also on the screen up on the wall. There's your books, and there's your show based on your books. How about that?
And then if I do that, maybe I have enough that I don't have to do a freaking day job.
Well, speaking of which, why don't we talk about what you are working on? Because I don't know many writers who only have a couple projects, a couple irons in the fire. Have you got some other things in mind that you're working on that we should be aware of?
So I've got some stuff that will be coming out. And, you know, I've done a little bit of work in there on some anthologies. And I've got a fair number of pitches in a Dropbox folder written up, ready to go. Mm-hmm. But one thing that kind of limits the amount of projects I can really work on at one time is because I'm just a writer, I need to like hire an artist and, you know, believe in paying an artist fair wages for fair work. So if I want to make a professional comic, I have to pay a professional rate for that. And just based off my own resources, I can really only afford to produce one comic at a time.
Okay.
So I have a good idea of what I'm going to do next, and I've got a good idea of who I'm going to do it with, and I think it'll be, again, different and cool, but at this point, absolutely nothing is set in stone, and I don't know. At this point, I'd be a fool to even try to predict the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe the way for us to proceed is to follow your website. Are you on Facebook and Twitter and things like
that? Yeah, I'm on Facebook at, you know, just regular Ben Con, and then I'm at Twitter at Ben the Con. Mm-hmm.
And we're going to point out again, it's K-A-H-N, not K-H-A-N, just so you make sure you get the right Ben Con in those things. And, you know, Ben, I have to say, I love what you're doing. I get a huge kick out of all the stuff. I love variety in my reading. I mean, I'm a big Long John's fan. I read, like, Batman's my guy, you know, and Scott Snyder is my writer right now.
Oh, he's the best.
Your stuff scratches that itch for me in something different. Something that, you know, after I've read my Batman, then I don't necessarily want to read a Batman alike. I want to read something else. And your books really do that for me. You give me that wonderful little scratching of the itch that needs to go somewhere else. And so I hope you have a lot of success with it. And I can't wait to see what I can't wait to see what you're going to do next. I can't wait to get the hold of these good things.
And me too, because I got to say, just as a writer, I fucking love seeing all this art come together. Comic book art is amazing, and to get to help create more of it is awesome. I would be remiss if I did not just give the hugest shout out in the world to Hidalgo, who's the artist on both Shaman and Heavenly Blues. And it was such just a beyond instrumental part in bringing these books to life and making them what they are.
A great fun. Now, one last question. I saw you at C2E2. Are there other conventions you're going to be at that people can look for you?
Yes, I have a busy convention schedule. I'm going to be at Five Points Festival in May. That's going to be May 20th and the 21st in New York. Then after that, I'm doing Wizard World Philly in June 1 through 4. After that, just a few weeks later, I've got Awesome Con in D.C., June 16th and 18th. After that comes Boston Comic Con, August 4th through 6th. And finally, rounding out the summer season is going to be FlameCon back in Brooklyn, New York for August 19th and 20th.
Okay, what about New York? Do you ever go to New York Comic Con?
I'm not going to have a table at the Artist Alley, but I've got my passes. And while I can't give you any like real scheduling information this far out, I'm sure I'll be doing something over at the Scout table.
Ah, okay, that's a good thing. Because that's how I re-encountered Brendan this past New York Comic Con. Table with Scout was right down the aisle from where I was. I was helping out a comic called Stabby Bunny. And I walked down there and I said, my gosh, I said, that's Brendan. I haven't seen you in a long time. So it was nice to talk with him.
Yeah, that was where I first met him, at New York Comic Con this past year.
Oh, cool. Cool. See, New York, I had to take a lot of things go on behind the scenes at conventions that people don't realize.
So yes.
I always like that kind of stuff. So I might see you at Wizard World Philly because we're going to be there at Philly as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I definitely come by and say hello. I'd love to see you there.
That'll be good. Maybe you'll have number 3 by then and I'll be able to buy that one from you.
No promises on that.
Okay. No, are you going to
see how it goes?
Are you going to self-publish at this point? Or are you going to go through Scout now?
I think that because by the time issue 3 would really be ready, issue 1's probably going to be like in stores. So at that point, I think I'd just rather wait for it to go through the natural publishing process.
That makes sense. That makes sense.
Yeah.
So that'll be, well, you can always get copies from Scout that you can sell.
Exactly. So
that'll be good. Well, Ben, you're doing wonderful stuff. Great reading. I love to do it.
Thank you.
I can't wait to read more of your stuff. When number 3 comes around, I'll be after it like crazy.
And can't wait to send it to you.
If you get more other trade ideas and good things in the future, I'd like to see it because it's all great fun. I really like what you're doing. And like I said, you do things that I don't know what you're going to do next. And as a comics reader who's been reading them for a long time, I've cherished that.
Thank you. You're making me blush so damn hard. Right. I'm not quite exactly sure what I'm going to do next, but I'm pretty excited about that.
Well, so am I. So I'm sure a lot of us will be. So we're looking forward to it.
Very cool.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored. I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
And that's it for this episode. Be back next time. I'll have another great interview with an excellent comics creator, something I'm sure you won't want to miss. But until then, keep reading your comics.